On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Google is tightening their data privacy controls. Facebook is shipping countertop video devices that are attempting to rival Amazon's. But privacy is a big concern. And Curtis, Brian, and I talk with Rajiv Dutt, CEO of Dimensional Mechanics, about making it easy for any organization to start producing insights from any data. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 312, recorded October 12th, 2018, NeoPulse AI Toolkit. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Avnet. Avnet and Not Impossible Labs created a historic event at the Life is Beautiful Musical Festival, a first of its kind, live concert that helped the deaf and hearing communities experience music in a whole new way. Visit avnet.com/music2 to see the journey. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresci, your guide through this giant world of the enterprise, but I can't guide you through this giant world alone. I need some help from some of the juggernauts into enterprise, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, how are you, my friend?
Louis, I'm doing well. I am really pleased to be here, and I'm going to take a moment to turn off my phone to show my happiness. This is going to be a great week. We've escaped the worst of what came through and devastated our state to the west of us. And then coming up this week, we've got two conferences where we're going to be going out. I'll talk about those at the end of the show, but in the meantime, really happy to be here on Twyatt.
Now, you have a squatter in your house this week, right?
I do indeed, very happily so. We've got Twyatt's estimable producer, Brian Chi, who is sitting a couple of rooms away from me, deftly handling things from behind the scenes.
fantastic. Well, thanks for being here, Curtis. Of course, we wanted to also welcome Mr. Brian McHenry. Now, Brian, we thank you for being on the show. We know you had to make some changes to your schedule to be here, and we appreciate you being here. Thanks for coming back.
It's always good to be on. This weekend we've got a little bit of leisure plan. So if anybody is a big music fan, I'm going to be going with my sons to see the Gorillaz in New York City tomorrow night, and we're pretty excited.
Fantastic. Well, I'm pretty excited about today's show. So today we're talking about voice assistants mania and their security, as well as we're going deep into AI. And this time we have a guest on the show that even talks about making AI more accessible to pretty much any organization. But like we always do, let's first go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, organizations know that when they ship a service or a network, especially a social one, they have to offer up a platform for it as well. And this is because they know what they offer won't always be enough for everyone. And the more the platform is open, the better for developers, and it makes it easier for them to actually have a return on investment and extend the platform. Well, this past month, Google was given a reminder, just like Facebook has, that platforms can sometimes be too open without transparency to end users of what data they're giving up to developers. Now, Google has made aware of APIs that granted developers access to their Google Plus data. Profiles of up to 500,000 Google Plus accounts were potentially affected. Google did call out that their analysis showed that up to 438 applications may have used the API. But although this bug was apparent between 2015 and 2018, Google responded immediately after having after the announcement with a new strategy and initiative to strengthen its data's integrity and security by focusing on users' transparency and privacy of their data. Now, they call it Project Strobe, and the first part of the project was to shut down Google Plus for consumers. Now, the next part is that they're launching more granular account Google account permissions that will actually show individual dialog boxes requiring users to consent, sometimes multiple times, to giving up data to apps. Now, this consent has a time limit as well, which means you can get it again in the near future and sometimes more frequent. They will also be limiting the types of use cases that are permitted. Along with the limited use cases, they're limiting apps' ability to receive call log and SMS permissions on Android devices and are no longer making contact interaction data available via the Android Contacts API. Now, this is essentially a turning the dial up to 500 when it comes to user transparency about their data, but we will see how this will affect on user experiences, and only you can decide how evasive it may be on your productivity. We'll just have to wait and see.
Well, what is becoming yet another battle in, a developing Cold War, a Chinese intelligence officer has been arrested for intellectual property theft. U.S. authorities have arrested a Chinese intelligence officer, Yan Junshu, for attempting to steal data on advanced aviation technology that GE Aviation, among others, had spent billions of dollars developing. The arrest comes amid numerous recent reports about an increase in cyber-enabled espionage involving China-backed actors and suggests that little has changed in the 3 years since China signed an agreement with the U.S., to refrain from backing such activity. According to John Demers, Assistant Attorney General for the U.S. Department of Justice's National Security Division, quote, "This case is not an isolated incident. It's part of an overall economic policy of developing China at American expense," end quote. Now, a recent report from CrowdStrike showed a sharp uptick in targeted intrusion attempts by China-backed actors against U.S. companies in industries including defense, biotech, and pharmaceutical. Chinese-based entities, in fact, were behind 40 of the 70 or so targeted intrusions in the first half of this year that CrowdStrike was able to find attribution for.
And in some good news, there are a lot of wonderful ways that data is making the world better. There are projects like Aqueducts applying data analysis to help find new water sources, and data analytics being applied to help fight malaria in Zambia. Bloomberg is also using data mining to help spur innovation, while blockchain maven Factom is using this merging data tool to fight healthcare corruption. So while we here at Twiat have often certainly highlighted data breaches, corruption, hacking, and other negative aspects of our connected world, there are certainly a large number of data-driven projects that are using emerging tools to help make the world a better place.
In addition, a positive note, we're talking a little bit about nostalgia for this week. Microsoft has finally opened source MS-DOS 1.25 and 2.0 over on GitHub, and it's under a standard MIT license, and you can view all the assembly goodness that made the OS prominent in its day. Now, this isn't the important thing that they made it open source, because the source is, to me, it's more about historical context and understanding where we've come from in technology and preserving the history and source of early computing. It also will give you your insights into that sawtooth history of MS-DOS, especially by reading the source's comments, where you can see why there are different differences and actually different instances of MS-DOS, such as the PC-DOS version for IBM version, as well as the MS-DOS version for Microsoft. And finally, if you ever wanted to emulate legacy computing environments, you need to know how the code runs. And this is your chance to see and understand the implementation and motivations behind the OS's details. Imagine running BASIC on the latest hardware today. It might even be able to run on IoT devices or microcontrollers. Then you will truly understand why historical OS's are relevant today.
It's amazing. I just got rid of my last machines running MS-DOS 1.25 during the move to my new studio. Well, Russian hackers have converged in a rare display of common techniques and technologies. In a rare overlap in malware delivery and targets, we saw recent activity that converged two separate and traditionally very different Russian hacking groups. Turla, also known as Venomous Bear, Snake, or Ouroboros, and Zipocracy, a subgroup of Sofaki, also known as Fancy Bear, or APT-28. And this appears to indicate some type of pooling of their resources. Researchers from Kaspersky Lab spotted the two using the same method of malware delivery used by each, going after some of the same geopolitical targets in Central Asia. Turla, which at one time was mostly targeting Ukraine, now appears more focused on foreign affairs targets in regions including East Asia as well as Europe. It's one of the oldest and longest-running advanced hacking teams in the world and is known to be stubbornly resilient, sticking with technologies and tactics even after discovered. Zebocracy is a lesser-known arm of Sofaki and is interesting because there's very little talk about them. Unlike Sofaki, which stays the course even after it gets outed, Turla is also known to shift tactics when it's discovered. And the coincidence of delivery mechanisms is meaningful because each group has a remarkable roster of resources at its command. Now, what remains to be seen is whether this was a one-time coincidence of effort or the beginning of a longer-lasting strategic criminal partnership.
And in news of other nation-state espionage and hacking, we like to decode the Chinese super micro super spy chip super scandal. What do we do now? Who's your money on? Is it Bloomberg sources, Apple, Amazon, Supermicro? The reports from Bloomberg sources seem credible with strong backgrounds in hardware security. The denials from Apple, Amazon, and Supermicro are all very carefully worded and were definitely vetted by very large groups of lawyers. What is clear is that we should be more closely vetting our hardware and cloud vendors for what protections they have in place against supply chain attacks. A few questions you can ask your vendors to gain better assurances that your enterprise systems are protected are: do you use third-party developed motherboards in the design of your systems? What, if any, part of the hardware design and development process do you control? What safeguards do you use to secure firmware and software updates? What level of security testing do you do on the hardware and when? Again, when in the manufacturing and design process? Finally, what protections do you have in place to prevent and detect tampering from any source throughout the supply chain? Now, we might not all get a chance to ask these types of detailed questions of our vendors. So one key feature you can look for from hardware vendor is a microcontroller known as the Trusted Platform Module, or TPM. This is a dedicated microcontroller that enables the verification of system integrity using cryptography.
So in the past year, we've heard more and more instances of crypto jacking practices happening in the wild. Now, as you know, crypto jacking is the process of using a computer's processing power to mine for cryptocurrencies without the owner's consent or knowledge. Well, new research released by Unit 42, Palo Alto Network's threat and intelligence team, has said that this might be more prominent in today's landscape than you think. They've identified cryptojacking malware that conceals itself behind a fake Adobe Flash update. Now, the developers of this malware copied the pop-up notification for an official Adobe installer. Plus, the download really does update the target's computer's Flash with the latest version of Flash, making it seem legitimate to the end user. Now, this makes for a very stealthy install as it runs, and it seems normal since the CPU is only utilized when you're using the browser. Now, as if you didn't need another reason to rid yourself of Adobe Flash, this just might be the nail in its coffin, finally. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites, where we talk about Facebook and its new video assistant. But first, before we do, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that's Avnet. Now, Avnet brings new meaning to groundbreaking technology and making it more accessible to everyone. Not Impossible Labs had an idea for tech that could revolutionize live music. Now, the team wanted to bring the experience of a concert to a group who had traditionally found it inaccessible, and that's actually the deaf community. Now, no doubt live music for people who can hear can sometimes be taken for granted, and it's an experience like no other because live music can literally affect any sense. Now, this is where Avnet took on the challenge to make this experience more accessible to everyone, including the deaf community. Now, with Avnet as their guide, their actually idea was to evolve the most sophisticated wearables on the market, helping them bring shared live concert music experiences to everyone. It's called Music Not Impossible, and the product allows deaf and hearing concert goers alike to literally feel live music through advanced vibration technology and experience it together for the first time. Now, those wearables are truly wearables in the strictest sense. As part of the experience, you wear a vest and components that send vibrations through the ankles and wrists and chest. Now, the hearing able receiving music vibrations through the ears, while attendees who are deaf and wearing the wearables receive those vibrations through other parts of their body, allowing many of them to respond to the live music alongside everyone else. Now, for many, this experience is basically an experience of a lifetime. It's an innovation that literally opens up a whole new world of music exploration to those who might not hear in the traditional sense. Now, Avnet and Not Impossible Labs revealed Music Not Impossible at the Life is Beautiful Music Festival in Las Vegas last month, and it was an instant success. Now, this kind of innovation was brought by the finish line because of Avnet. And, you know, I truly love hearing about amazing and inspiring tech as these sponsors come to This Week in Enterprise Tech. And this is some really cool stuff. Now, visit avnet.com/music2 to see the journey. That's avnet.com/music2. And we thank Avnet for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, now we get to jump into the bites, and this is actually a pretty interesting bite because this is, you know, obviously we've heard about many different video assistants or countertop video units that have been coming out, and obviously we know about Amazon's units, and you know, now we're starting to hear a little bit about some of the devices coming from Facebook. Now, the company has announced a new Portal and Portal Plus device that are basically direct competitors of the Amazon devices. And not only do the devices combine Alexa, they are soon having Google Assistant, and they also offer countertop video chat, Zoom, and as well as it zooms to the person who's talking. But it's also looking to add entertainment as well, Spotify, Pandora, and Bluetooth activated media. The devices are launching at $199 for the 10-inch screen and $349 for the 16.6 swivel screen unit that also comes with hi-fi audio. Okay, so with the advent of Cambridge Analytica data breach from Facebook and this year's election coming up, I want to throw this over to Curtis first. Is this smart for Facebook to debut such a device now, with people so on edge with their data coming from Facebook?
Well, I think what you really have is Facebook coming out with a product where it had established a runway for this product probably a year and a half ago. It's just unfortunate for them that some of the things have happened in the last 6 to 12 months that have. The fact is that we've seen over and over again that most consumers really don't care. You know, there will be an uproar about any of the notices of privacy violations. There will be some users who decide that this particular incident is the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back. But most people will, you know, go online, complain about it for a little while, and then get on with using the service. Facebook's counting heavily on that. They're also counting on the fact that while we have been told so often about people leaving screens, what we really have is a reimagining of the screens. On the one hand, you have the entertainment screens that are ginormous, the projection screens that go up to 120 inches or more diagonally that are being used for sort of special occasion viewing in the home. But for most things, most people are doing their viewing of entertainment, of communicating with one another, of getting basic information on fairly small screens. For that, Facebook wants to be part because they want the revenue that's going to come from the ads that are shown to people looking at those screens. And the opportunity for that revenue outweighs any considerations they have about, well, privacy concerns. Now, I've got a problem with this due to the way they do advertising, but I want to come back to that because I would love to hear what you and Brian McHenry have to say about this whole topic.
Absolutely. Thank you, Curtis. So I want to actually call something that the Facebook VP has said. Facebook's VP of Portal actually assured customers that since they had to build the hardware, software, and AI from scratch, they built privacy into every layer of the device and its systems. So to me, that seems, I mean, obviously that's just a stretch for them, because at this point, you know, like you said, Curtis, they might have already had these devices in the manufacturing process and in the development phase the last couple of years. And so they decided, hey, like, we're done with this. We want to ship this thing and we don't want to wait any longer, especially before the holiday season's here. So we're going to ship them anyways to catch that ride. But I think that there's really not much they can do at this point. I mean, just to say, I mean, obviously to say that they're doing better with privacy is a good start, but I don't know if it's enough. Brian, I want to throw it to you. Is it enough for this social giant to basically say that, hey, we've built this thing to have privacy built in. Don't worry, you guys are safe.
Well, trust but verify. I think that's the ultimate way that this has to be handled. Apple's shown with a lot of the controversy over end-to-end encryption of iMessage and encryption of backups in the iCloud and so on, and the federal government wanting to have access to that, law enforcement wanting to have access to it. Apple's kind of shown the way that, you know, building hardware and privacy features into the hardware is actually a selling point. Don't know that I necessarily doubt that Facebook always had privacy in mind when designing these devices a year and a half, 2 years ago, even before they were implicated in all these scandals. However, you know, I think it's once this stuff hits the street more broadly, it'll be interesting to see, you know, who's the first, you know, hacker that does a disassembly and breakdown of just how much privacy is built in at all these layers, as the VP claims.
Right, right. It's interesting. PC guy 8088 in the chat room said, "Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you." This is going to be like we've been saying. It's going to be mixed reviews coming from the public, but I'm sure that many people will utilize this device. In fact, Chibert's telling me that in the chat room here that Padre actually has been trying this device and he's enjoyed it quite a bit. So there's going to be many different instances where people are going to be able to utilize this and make use out of it. Now, Curtis, I want to throw it back to you, because I do want to hear your point of view when it comes to this delivery mechanism as well.
Well, the whole reason behind Facebook doing a box like this comes down to advertising. Facebook pays for itself through advertising. But here's the secret, and it's both good and bad, mostly bad for consumers. Many of the Facebook ads aren't sold directly to the advertisers. Instead, they're sold to advertising networks or advertising syndicates. So you get an ad that's a secondhand ad. But many of those advertising networks will themselves sell spots to advertising networks, which sell to syndicates, which sell to networks. So by the time a company advertises to you on Facebook, it may well be 5, 6, 7 or more steps removed from Facebook itself. In many ways, that's how some of the privacy violations have happened. Facebook could say, well, we didn't know what was happening. And they're telling the truth. They didn't, because they did not sell that ad space directly to the company buying it, which also means they didn't directly sell your information to the company that was consuming it. They were selling to someone they trusted. But as anyone who has dealt with supply chain knows, by the time you get a couple of steps removed in that whole customer-supplier relationship, the chains of trust start to get stretched to the limit. So while you might be willing to give Facebook the benefit of the doubt, do you give everyone they sell to and everyone they sell to and they sell to and they sell to the benefit of the same doubt? That's where the privacy concerns really come in for me. Not in the relationship that Facebook directly has with the advertisers, but with those removes that can approach double digits in number, each one of which clouds the responsibility and the security of the information being traded for your eyeballs.
Right. Well, I think the interesting thing is they say, hey, you can disable audio and video with just a tap, and they also have a plastic privacy shield to cover the camera, so that should be enough, right? Well, let's actually talk about the tech here. They have a chip for local detection which only activates when the portal hears that they're, of course, their wake word, the wake word. And it doesn't save recordings, and the data connection is actually encrypted from the device. It actually has a really pretty good 4-inch subwoofer built in, which actually has a large range. And the camera has a pretty neat, unique feature that actually has a zoom feature that targets the person that's actually talking. And this is interesting because Qbert has been ranting for a while about the H323 video conferencing units from like Polycom or Tanberg, where they were a dying breed. But now that the video conferencing desktop units and countertop units are now coming back, this might actually revive this type of technology. Now, I think Skype for many years has had this, the Xbox integration and some other camera integrations that actually zooms to the person to make that interesting as an interesting thing. Brian, I wanted to throw it over to you because I think the interesting thing here is they are trying to bring back like this kind of conference style, this like desktop style or countertop style conferencing back to the masses. Do you think that people are ready, or are they just going to use their mobile devices?
So I think the ubiquity of video everywhere has gotten people a lot more comfortable with being on camera. I think, you know, the ease of use that Apple brought with FaceTime has kind of broken that boundary of, hey, I'm okay being on camera. You know, first thing in the morning over a cup of coffee, I'm much more likely to answer a video call. I don't have to be, you know, quote unquote camera ready. So that's a big shift in what I see in both the business and the family spaces, right? So at F5, for example, you know, we've recently switched over to a new video conferencing solution, and there's been a huge uptake in everybody wanting to be on video for all conferences, all our meetings, rather than, you know, just joining a conference via the phone or you know, just purely audio. So I've seen a big shift in the last, you know, 10 to, you know, 12 months where people are using video, you know, using FaceTime instead of making a phone call, right? So I think there's a big shift culturally, both in the workplace and at home, with people being much more comfortable with being on camera. So the time might be right for this sort of device, whereas, you know, the Xbox integrations with Skype and stuff might have been a little bit ahead of what people were ready for.
Right. So that, you know, I haven't seen a Apple device that actually does this yet. I'm sure that we'll maybe see that soon, so that we can offer FaceTime from that same kind of location. But it has been announced that Skype will actually be coming to Amazon devices soon. So Curtis, I want to kind of throw it over to you, because does Facebook have any play here in the enterprise space to kind of bring these types of devices to the enterprise?
Well, I think that Facebook is going to be following in some ways the Apple playbook. I don't think they're going to market these as enterprise devices, but in the same way that you now have things like Slack that has Alexa tie-ins, you have so many of the DevOps tools that have Alexa skills. I don't think it'll be very long at all before you have those same skills for the DevOps and collaboration tools being ported to the Facebook technology. That makes it an enterprise problem. That makes it security issues, enterprise issues. And if I'm in enterprise IT security, that means that I'm going to be on the list to get one of these as quickly as I can so that I can begin the long process of understanding it, understanding how it's going to tie into my infrastructure and what on earth I can do to protect my users from the effects of having this on their desk.
Right. Well, we'll have to see. We'll have to see what kind of market play they have this holiday season. Well, folks, that does it for the Bytes. Next up, we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, I remember buying my last house, and it was not a fun process. I had to deal with multiple banks. I had to do constant communications with different bank reps. I had to search around my house and the filing cabinets for information. I also had to worry about interest rate hikes as well. And it was nerve-wracking, and it seemed to take forever. Now, the market today is pretty unpredictable, which means interest rates are changing all the time, especially with the latest Fed changes that were announced recently. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage noticed all the pitfalls in the process, and they're doing something about it. They're calling it the power buying process. Now, here's how it works. Quicken Loans will verify your income, assets, and credit in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval. Now, what is that? Well, this gives you the strength of a cash buyer. And in the current market, that is a huge advantage as a buyer because sometimes you have to put offers in at a moment's notice right at an open house. Now, once you're verified, you qualify for their all new exclusive Rate Shield approval. Now, first, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here's the best part. If the rates go up, your rate stays the same. And that's actually pretty advent into today's market. Now, if you're probably thinking, well, if the rate goes down, they won't tell me about it. Well, that's not the case here. If the rate goes down, your rate also drops. Now, if you ask me, as a buyer, you seem to have the upper hand here because either way, you win. Now, this is just the kind of thinking we would expect from America's largest mortgage lender, Rocket Mortgage. Now, if you've been thinking about buying a house, go out right now to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise, and in less than 10 minutes, your info could be entered and you can be on your way to home buying freedom. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. That is rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on our Twilight Riot. And today is no exception. We have Rajiv Dutt, CEO of Dimensional Mechanics. Rajiv, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Now, Rajiv, before we kind of jump into data, machine learning, AI, our audience loves to hear origin stories. Can you maybe give the audience a quick journey through your experiences in tech up until Dimensional Mechanics?
Sure. I've been coding since about, I guess, the age of 10 or so. I was playing games that were not particularly intelligent. And so I decided, okay, well, I wanted to make games more fun. And so I started kind of playing with my first kind of in quotation marks AI, which was kind of expert systems sort of approaches, and made games definitely a lot more interesting. And from that point onwards, I just fell in love with the whole concept. So I kept developing and coding, and ended up actually doing theoretical physics in university. After that, I joined my first company. It was a AI startup based out of London. I worked there for a while. I worked for the BBC in their media group, also doing some AI work. I was then recruited by HP. Worked there for a while, doing a lot of AI work in between. I had my own startup sort of between all these different companies, again, in AI. So needless to say, it's been a theme in my life. I've been kind of working in this space, pretty much experimenting with everything from expert systems right up to sort of more recently deep learning. I worked for Microsoft for a while as well in the CoreOS division. I was hired from there to join Intel. Did some additional work, in this case kind of relating some of the it was sort of this issue with pre-silicon versus post-silicon, being able to predict whether or not, like how the bugs were related and whether or not you can actually identify issues before even the silicon has actually been etched in a way. So this company was started about 3 years ago. It seemed like it was almost inevitable given everything else that I was doing in my life that I would eventually do this. It was sort of a childhood dream, and here I am today.
Fantastic. Now, it's safe to say you're probably an expert in this area. You have a little bit of experience in this area. Now, I wanted to first start to help our audience along the way. Obviously, AI and machine learning are big in the enterprise space today, and So what are some of the challenges that organizations are facing when it comes to bringing this into their organization and start utilizing it?
Well, I think that the biggest issue is data. A lot of organizations are simply not ready from that perspective. So let me just, I guess, take a step back and talk about give a layout of the landscape. So on one hand, you have sort of the cognitive service providers. They're kind of the Google and Microsofts. They're sitting on piles of data, and what they do is they train models using ever innovative approaches that they then expose via a service to the rest of the world, so you can make access that via an API call. So that's one side. On the other side are custom models, and this is kind of the 80% part of the market. So most businesses are actually trying to look at building models based on analytic data, and unfortunately, in many cases, it's usually poorly structured. There isn't enough of it, and so oftentimes the models that are built are not really that robust. And so that's one of the major factors. The second, honestly, is skill set. I was just talking to somebody the other day. Their son just graduated from MIT, has never worked in the tech industry before. His starting salary is $350,000. I know that some senior ML people can earn up to like between $1 to $2 million. So it's like the salaries are just absolutely insane at the moment in the machine learning space. So this is kind of the second part. And the third big third major issue is lack of governance and lack of operation. I call it operationalizability. I don't know whether there's a word for that, but what that basically is the ability to control what actually gets into production. So these are sort of governance issues, determining the lifetime of an AI model when it goes out there. Is there data provenance? Do you know where how this model was trained? What was the architecture of the model? Does it have a retirement plan in place? So all of these things need to be thought of. And on top of that, how do you integrate that into an IT framework, which is, of course, a big challenge that IT departments in particular are facing right now.
Right. Yeah, I think the interesting thing is a lot of organizations, well, they'll go and say, hey, we have all this data. We want to make use of it. Obviously, it's a smart thing to do, especially for our investors, in order to help new products and advance our services and so on and solutions. So we're going to go pay a company because obviously we don't have experts in this area. So we're going to go pay a company a couple hundred thousand, maybe even over a quarter of a million dollars to kind of get this up and running. And then they don't always have a really good return on investment on it. So how is your company, Dimensional Mechanics actually helping with that process?
Well, our platform is it's called NeoPulse. And with NeoPulse, NeoPulse itself is powered by an AI. So it's literally an AI that builds AI. And the funny story is this AI that builds AI, part of it was built by the AI, which is very meta. But what we do is we fully automate the process of building learning models. So that's actually a major piece of that. So by being able to do that, you allow a couple of things to happen. The first is a rapid iteration. So we had a team, for example, come here. And in the course of about a month, they were able to generate 20 different models, just tweaking their data, running a new model, tweaking it, running. Currently, that's not really feasible given the time lags and the length of time it takes to design an architecture and so on, design a new neural network architecture, for example. But with our platform, since it happens automatically, the iteration cycles are really short. Within about 2 or 3 days, you're already ready to try something else, which means that you can experiment. And that's actually part of the heart of building good machine learning solutions. So we kind of help with that. Another major issue is standardization of deployment. One of the things that we really like is, coming from a little bit of my background, is I've also done a lot of work in the enterprise space. And one of the things that matters are standards. And so one of the beautiful parts of what we do, the part I'm really excited about, is being able to deploy to end targets that could be from IoT devices to mobile devices, which means that a company doesn't have to switch to go from one framework to another. With one framework, with a single click, you can basically deploy to any kind of device, whether it's an ARM64 machine or an x86 machine.
So let me take a step back for a second, because I do want to bring the audience through the technology of this. So you said that for instance, the organization comes along, they have a bunch of data, they want to mm-hmm. make use of it, so they kind of come to the company. What do they do to get started? What's kind of the first part of the process for them? You said that you have something called AI Studio, and I do want to get into a question later about how AI actually built AI, but that's later on down the road. I want to first start and think, okay, organization has data. What do they do to get started? How do they ingest that data? How do they get going?
Right. So right now we have a couple of options. One is we have a cloud. We're on AWS as well as in Azure. So we're available as an AMI. So literally what you do is you have your data. You generate a CSV file corresponding to that data, which could exist on an S3 instance on AWS. You connect it up to your to AI Studio. You write one of the things we did was we created a new language called the NeoPulse modeling language. And the NeoPulse modeling language, we kind of call it the sequel of machine learning, because in 14 lines of code, you can essentially build an entire a model from soup to nuts, basically. And the way that you do this is you'd write your 14 lines of code, you submit it to AI Studio. AI Studio will build the model for you. And then once it's ready for deployment, it wraps it up in something called a portable inference model, which is a construct we've created, which is platform neutral. And you just plop it onto a machine where our runtime is there, so which is called NPQR, so the NeoPulse Query Runtime, which is also available on AWS and Azure. And from there on, you can basically query your model without actually writing any extra code. You just literally run one command. The PIM is now instantiated and is ready for querying. So the overall process is kind of, think about it as you have your data, you submit it to AI Studio with the NML code, which is basically instructions and what kind of model you want to generate and so on. AI Studio will use the AI to build an AI to generate the portable inference model. Once the portable inference model is ready to go, you just dump it onto a machine with a runtime on it. And the runtime will then allow you to query or interrogate the model without having to write any much code. It's just really a REST call from that point. Right. So the REST interface is automatically generated.
So an interesting question for you is, and this is coming from the chat room. So is this like a serverless kind of model? Is this a service that you host? Do you use your own infra? Can you host it in a cloud? Can you host it locally on your network? How do you kind of get this going?
So you have several options. The first is it's available as an AMI on AWS and on Azure, which means that you just run it in your own account. So an AMI basically is sort of a virtual image that exists on AWS or on Azure. Which means that you run it in your own cloud. The other option is we do have an on-premise version.
Oh, cool.
Of AI Studio, so you can install it locally, and we're actually going to be coming up with an appliance very soon, which is a very high-end supercomputer with our with AI Studio built on board. So it's kind of literally plug and play. So you don't really need to do anything about that. And our runtime is basically available again on premise and on devices, and also available in the cloud as an AMI as well. So you have plenty of choices in terms of how you want to use it and implement it.
Now, you said the obviously AI Studio and the models can be implemented in these different environments. Now, you also mentioned that the runtime can actually run potentially on IoT and Android devices as well, so they can actually process these models on those devices.
Exactly. So it's a low power. So the runtime, so without having to kind of recompile or rebuild the models, you can essentially put them on any kind of ARM device, ARM64 device or IoT device. In fact, we're currently in conversations with a couple of chip makers to look at ways of developing even tighter integration. The advantage is it's literally like you build it once, you code it once, and you deploy everywhere. Think Java in the old days. where the target of Java was to essentially enable broad deployment of applications. So we kind of, and you needed a runtime, so essentially we offer that runtime that allows you to exist on any end target.
Now, for actually developing, doing the code here, you actually mentioned that you have a new language. Now, why did you? I'm actually always curious because I've utilized many backend services, whether it's telemetry services or other data services that do use new languages. Some very similar to SQL, but they produce more kind of functionality with them. Why did you choose a new language? And how accessible is that to, like, you know, current developers or maybe just IT pros?
Well, the reason for creating the language was that one of the things we realized was coding in regular Python was tedious, and you're basically repeating yourself quite a bit. I mean, the analogy is like going from assembly language to C. Sure, you can write everything in assembly language, but why would you for many problems? So what we have is so what NML does is it essentially essentially wraps a lot of these basic capabilities, wraps these functionalities in a way that makes it invisible to the developer engineer. So some of these things, for example, would be pre-processing of the data. It would be marshaling the data for training. IO kind of operations. It would be the generation of. We have introduced a new keyword called auto, which basically tells the AI that we call the Oracle. It tells the AI that, hey, I need your help. We're all geeks, which is the Matrix. So it tells the Oracle that, hey, I need help here with this architecture. And it comes back and builds the architecture or determines what is the ideal loss function or optimizer or hyperparameter to use for that particular problem. So it depends on the level of granularity that you need it. So the language offers us the ability to write an amazing amount of to create really complex models with very little code. In-house, NML is used a lot inside our company. It's kind of eating our own dog food, and it's just because of the fact that we save so much time. We don't actually have to write a lot of code to kind of go very far. In terms of how easy it is to learn, we have had Stanford physicians use it, so to actually build models. So these are people with no prior software engineering skills experience or machine learning experience, and they were able to kind of build models. And in fact, one of the papers based on our on NeoPulse will be published at the RSNA, so the that's Radiology Society of North America. They have a big conference in Chicago every year, and the results will be published there. We've also had high school students use us, so that's pretty cool. And so all of that is makes it so it's very easy to learn, very easy to pick up. You can pick it up in an afternoon to become proficient at it and to really write some advanced code. It is Turing complete, so to write really advanced code. Of course, it'll take much longer, but right. To really get going and writing your kind of hello world types of applications, it could learn it in an afternoon. And our hello world is writing full classification models. So that's more.
So the interesting thing, so you were saying it's kind of a wrapper around some functionality of the verbose, as verbose as Python might be. The interesting thing about Python that I see in the community, especially when it comes to deep learning, is there are a pretty large ecosystem. So there's tons of libraries that do specific things like Keras or MXNet or SKLearn, Athenio. Is there some similar, like, do you offer just out of the box functionality that's more higher level? Functional aspects of that type of thing, or do they still have to import libraries like that?
So we actually have, a lot of it is already embedded inside AI Studio. So everything that currently, for example, exists in NumPy or TensorFlow or something is accessible through NML. So you could write arbitrarily complex code and actually leverage sort of the best of breed if you wanted to and really write your own layers. And you could definitely do that. And a lot of the underlying functionality is accessible. Like you can make function calls to that level. Just as you can, for example, write assembly language in C, you can also kind of make underlying calls to TensorFlow if you need to. But for the most part, we don't need that because a lot of the most of the complexity has been already wrapped up, and you can leverage. So you don't need to. It's very rare that you need to go down to that level that you actually need to do anything like that.
Got it. Cool. This is really fascinating stuff. Well, you know, when we come back, I actually want to talk a little bit more about training and some other things as well. And I want to bring my co-host back in as well. So, but before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And of course, that's DigitalOcean. Now, as a developer, I can tell you the ability to experiment with your apps and sometimes build and deploy them is hard because it's hard to find a truly hosted environment and get it going and up and running right away. Well, DigitalOcean removes that impedance of cloud deployments and hosting, and they make it easier than ever to deploy your applications and code and store things on cloud storage without all those steps and monotonous steps in between. Now, DigitalOcean is something that I love that they do is that they actually name things pretty neat, starting with DigitalOcean's Droplets, which are actually super scalable virtual machines that you can add on storage, security, monitoring capabilities with just one click of a button. They also have really great one-click deployment models that make it easy for you to bootstrap that project of yours. And, that, and of course, any specific distribution of Linux, you can click deploy Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, and more. And let's say you want to actually one-click deploy an application stack as well. Well, they have Docker and LAMP and MongoDB, Node.js, MySQL, and more. And not only is it easy to deploy, it's actually easy to manage as well. They have this ability to do VM snapshots, which makes it super simple for you to manage your data and your current state. And for me, it's kind of a peace of mind to have that last known good state always one click away. Plus, they have team management and unified collaboration, which helps your teams manage and scale your infrastructure and apps. Now, you need more security for your infrastructure? Well, there's also one-click ads for cloud firewalls for your droplets or your droplet groups as well. Now, get this. Cloud firewalls are actually free. Now, don't let that free tag actually fool you because these firewalls are not just low-tier systems or just for testing environments. These are actually production-ready firewalls that can scale with your business. Now, to meet the demands of market, DigitalOcean follows the great model of pay-for-play pricing, and it's actually makes it really easy for clear and concise payment models, and it helps you grow your system out as easily with no more complexity to understand future bills or paying your current ones. You want to add more block storage to your system? Well, just add 10 cents per gigabyte per month, and you have to worry less about peace of mind to make sure that your backend can scale. Now, if your site becomes a lot more popular than before and you need to scale quickly, they also offer load balancers, and they're highly available, fully managed services that work right out of the box and can be deployed as fast as a droplet. Now, if you're like me, you love to write scripts and manage things as well, and DigitalOcean has you covered. Now, as an API guy, I can tell you they have some pretty great APIs. These are just standard HTTP requests to deploy, manage thousands of droplets and resources in a simple programmatic way. Now, there's tons of reasons you should consider DigitalOcean, even some of the extra stuff they don't charge you for, like enterprise class SSDs, 99.99% uptime SLA, full DNS management, and more. DigitalOcean has you covered. Now, there's no reason why you shouldn't go out right now and try DigitalOcean, especially to support us here on TWiT. Go to do.co/TWiT. And even if you think you might have a project in the future, go there right now, get set up, sign up today, and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. That's do.co/twit for a free $100 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, we're talking with Rajiv Dutt, CEO of Dimensional Mechanics, about their machine learning and AI platform that they have. Rajiv, this is some really interesting stuff, and I know we've actually talked a little bit about organizations, how they actually ingest their data in the system, how they get it processing, and how they write their models, and how they can actually program using this NML language that you actually have. I did want to ask one other thing. So you talked a little bit about how you can actually export these models. Now, are they in a standard format, or is it a special format that are just kind of used and available for the runtime that you support? Or are they models that can be ingested in other systems?
So right now the model, it basically exports it into a format that requires our runtime to access. And the reason for that is we have a lot of reasons, actually. One of the reasons is firstly security, because If you want a real runtime deployment, sometimes you may not necessarily want to reveal the underlying architecture to the end users. So this could be what you'd end up doing is you'd build it on in AI Studio. It encapsulates it. You can potentially hide it from whoever's using it. We give you the opportunity to include the architecture design in the actual document in the actual PIM file, but you don't need to. In addition to that, there's a lot of other metadata which could include things like provenance, author, location, functionality, description of the data, all kinds of additional things that you think that would be relevant so that you can build trust, also versioning information, all that you can build trust in terms of the PIMs that are generated, and which unfortunately there isn't really a very clean way of doing that on by just simply leveraging external or outside applications. Down the line, we may opt for a different, we may expand it out to allow execution in other environments. But right now, the neatest way is to essentially require our runtime because that it makes it a lot easier to kind of protect your assets, to control, to ensure that you've got the right amount of metadata going across for governance and management purposes. And the runtime also itself exposes a set of REST APIs that allow you to manage models that are currently in production as well. So it offers a whole set of additional services on top, which basically make it very easy to control what's actually in production and to implement life cycle strategies and things like that.
Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in because they have some pretty great questions. They're chomping at the bit here in the chat room. Curtis, I want to start with you first. I want to get your thoughts on from the enterprise space kind of point of view.
Well, my first question is a little bit technical. You're talking about the whole idea of AI training AI. And as you pointed out, training these engines is really the most expensive part of any deployment. My question comes to training bias. If you have an AI training another AI, don't you have the opportunity for a situation where you end up amplifying a training bias, where the bias of one AI is amplified as it trains another?
So the short answer is yes. That's always a risk. But one of the things that we do is there are a couple of mitigations that we have. The first is we look at the underlying the data itself, because that's usually where most of the biases in the models come from. It's like whether or not your data is correctly balanced, whether there are any anomalies in your data that should be removed, and things like that. So those are the kind of decision points that need to happen kind of before you even kind of start training. So we're in the process of working on a set of tools and technologies to allow people to determine and, for example, establish whether or not your data set is balanced, to be able to determine things like whether there are anomalies in your data, if you're trying to do time series, see if your data is stationary, to make sure that there's just not that you're not looking at just noise, to do basic things like that, which are things that you can do to essentially remove bias or identify kind of trends or underlying patterns in your data. Once it actually goes through that, and you have and once it goes through this analytics suite that we're creating right now, the AI takes over at that point and will build your model for you. The thing to think about, though, is that the AI itself gets better over time. So, I mean, the whole part of the logic that we have is that over time there is self-improvement, so it actually gets better. It actually develops. So there's a mechanism in place for it to learn from its mistakes. And so this is something that over time, in some subsequent versions of AI Studio, what we'll be doing is exploiting that even more, and actually talk about AI like Oracle of Oracles. So something that can essentially learn from the mistakes of a lot of designs and try and kind of like build up a master suite of things that of highly functional models for a company. Does that answer your question?
No, that's great. My other question has to deal with some sort of foundational definitions. We've been using the terms machine learning and artificial intelligence here in the conversation. Mm-hmm. From an operational standpoint, how do you distinguish between those two? I mean, marketers tend to use them, but you know, do you make a distinction that makes a practical difference between the two terms?
Well, machine learning, so AI includes a lot of different techniques, some of them which are procedural, some of like you have sort of direct, like more, I mean, they're everything, things like, for example, K-means, PCA, these are all could be examples of machine learning. But I mean, if before that, even if you just talk about AI, I mean, expert systems are a type of AI. Then if you go beyond that, then you've got machine learning where the actual system develops additional capabilities as a result of without being explicitly programmed. And then if you go further than that, like deep learning is a subset of machine learning where it's just another approach to kind of, it's another machine learning problem. So from our perspective, AI is the overarching bucket, which could include everything from procedural to machine learning kinds of algorithms. And then machine learning is a subset of AI. So that's kind of like what our operational definition is.
Fantastic. Now, Bam, I know you had some questions about implementation.
Yeah, so I always like to bring our guests back to what I think our audience cares most about is what are the kind of outcomes the enterprise IT professional can expect from an implementation in NeoPulse? For example, is this something I could apply to, you know, the large volumes of, you know, log data to determine maybe do I have an insider threat roaming on my network, or maybe there's some sort of attack mounting coming from outside my network that maybe I should put some sort of countermeasures or additional sensors in place based on, you know, what NeoPulse learns and tells me about the data that I have available.
I think the answer is we basically work with many, many different types of data types. So we work with audio, video, text, images, as well as new sort of kind of classical vector data, which would be sort of straight numerical. So the regression or time series types of problems as well. So we work the entire spectrum, and including now actually medical data. And very soon also some other, we'll probably announce that in about a month's time, some additional data types as well that we are starting to support. In terms of the volume of data, so we've actually worked with like one large network appliance manufacturer and to predict things like CPU utilization on machines to actually determine whether they're out of whack with what's expected. We have done work with large volumes of like financial data to actually make predictions on the volatility index market. We have done work in sales predictions, so forecasting the next quarter sales. So the volume of data can be pretty can vary quite considerably. So on one extreme, you have kind of sales kind of forecasting data. On the other extreme, you have like large volumes of data coming in from kind of network or infrastructure behavior and things like that.
And so specifically on that last point about network or infrastructure data that might be coming in, do you have any specific examples? Because that's something that I think our audience would really love to hear about, is a specific example where this was applied to, you know, the enterprise IT infrastructure and to maybe find efficiencies or other gains.
Well, we're currently, and this is unfortunately the case with a lot of machine learning projects, is that a lot of these things are kind of in POC stage. But we do have a couple of POCs going in this space. One is basically to look at and it's with this network company that we're talking with, who we're currently working with. They're looking at, for example, CPU behavior in their network infrastructure. So which means identifying like utilization of machines and making predictions about whether or not a machine is operating within expected parameters or whether or not a machine is exceeding limits of what it should be, basically. The second one is also on data center energy consumption. So in this case, there are several approaches. For example, being able to identify whether machines are idle or whether they are actually being used, because even an idle machine, there's a ton of traffic going back and forth, and it is being utilized in some way. But is that utilization real, or is it as a result of background operations? And so being able to determine things like that. By identifying those kind of elements, you could potentially lower the cost of data center costs. And there are many other things you can do as well. So those are some two examples in the infrastructure space that have recently come to that we're recently looking at. There have been some additional types of work, which I unfortunately can't go into a lot of detail with, is in the smart city area. So with sensors and with data coming in from large smart cities environment, as well as in kind of the fog computing space as well.
Fantastic. Rajiv, unfortunately we run out of time, but I do want to ask one last question here. Is Skynet coming?
I don't think so, but I think we're quite a ways off from that. All I can say is that when our AI starts to, I mean, it is writing itself, and it's getting better, and it's going to be more involved in its own creation. It'll be interesting to see what comes out of that.
Fantastic. Rajiv Dutt, CEO of Dimensional Mechanics, thanks again for being on. Can you maybe tell the folks at home where they can go to get started, learn a little bit more about Dimensional Mechanics and some of your frameworks and platforms?
Absolutely. The best place would be our main webpage, which would be www.dimensionalmechanics.com. You can also do a search for AWS NeoPulse or Azure NeoPulse. You'll get information from that. You can get information about our APIs through docs.neopulse.ai. If you do a search for just NeoPulse, you'll come up with Samsonite luggage. So it should be NeoPulse AWS or NeoPulse Dimensional Mechanics or something like that. And so those are the best places.
Thanks so much. Well, folks, unfortunately, we've run out of time. You've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best staying enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 Skynet nodes. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to our co-hosts with whom I wouldn't want to do this show, starting with Mr. Brian McHenry. Brian, thanks so much for changing your schedule to be on the show. Where the folks can find you and all of your work.
As always, check me out on Twitter at BA McHenry, and also devcentral.f5.com, where all the F5 community gets together and shares what's working, what's not, and how to fix those things that aren't.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Brian. And of course, we have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can the people find you and all of your fancy work?
Well, you can always find my writing over at darkreading.com. Happy to have you read my stuff, comment on it, and I'll generally post to let people know I'm going to have a piece up at my Twitter account there at KG4GWA. Now, in real life, in the next week, I'm going to be at two different conferences. First, the big Gartner Symposium IT Expo is at Disney this week. I'll be over there rubbing elbows with all of the C-level execs that come in for Gartner. And at the same time, the Internet 2 Tech Expo will be happening at Universal Studios. So I'll be heading over there to see what's happening in the world of Internet 2. And for both of those, I will very happily have the company of our producer and co-host, Mr. Brian Chi. So we'll be out and about. If you're attending either one, please, if you see us, come on over, say hello. We love to meet members of the Twiat Riot.
Curtis, Bam, thanks for being here. It's always great to have you, and I look forward to doing this again with you guys soon. Of course, I have to thank all of you as well. You are the people who drop in each and every week. You are our loyal listeners and followers. You come here to get your enterprise goodness, and we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen on the show. So go out right now to twit.tv/Twiat. There you will find all of our amazing episodes, our back episodes, information about the show, our guests, our co-hosts, and of course, all the show notes as well. But more importantly, next to those videos that you're watching live You can actually get those buttons there to the right there to actually subscribe to your video of your choice, the audio version of your choice. And you can listen on any one of your devices as well. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. Now, after you subscribe, go ahead and share the show with your friends, family, coworkers. We love doing this show. And if you share that out, we can continue to do it each and every week. Now, after you subscribe, also remember, we do this show live each and every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time right here at live.twit.tv. Come see how the show is run, all the behind the scenes, as well as if you're going to jump in live, you might as well jump into the IRC channel live as well, the chat channel, and that's irc.twit.tv. Also, don't forget you can follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. You get all the see all the things that I do during my week and my job as well at Microsoft. In fact, you want to check out some stuff that I do is dev.office.com. You can check out all the cool things you can do with Office and extend it and make it better and more usable for your organization. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially Leo and Lisa, who continue to support us each and every week to doing This Week in Enterprise Tech. I also want to thank our tireless producer, Mr. Brian Chi, who's traveling this week, but he has some pretty good company down there in Florida. He helps customize the show and get our guests and get everything kind of nice and greasy and nice and easy and flowing. And I also want to thank everyone, including our TD today, Alex. Thank you so much for TDing us. You want to tell the folks at home maybe like what the show's title, I mean, what the show's subject was today?
I believe it was Neopets.
Ah, so close. Unfortunately, it was the universal function approximation theory, but you were so close. Maybe next time. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.